Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Va a llegar el gol del Arsenal. Ozil marca. Mesut Ozil.
This is Arscast Extra.
Hello and welcome to another Arscast Extra, as always, with James from Gunnerblog. James, good morning to you.
Good morning to you too. How are you doing?
I'm okay. I'm feeling a bit disappointed, I have to say, because I went into this Brighton game full of hope, full of optimism, with a strong belief that we would win the game.
Sure.
And that was entirely down to you.
Yeah, hurting myself.
Yeah, I saw your Twitter, saw you with a bit of a cast on your arm, and I thought, well, if that doesn't fucking augur well for this game, I don't know what does. And lo and behold, we lost. We lost, well, and it's prompted a question from one of our listeners, Vanig Bostanian, who says, is it safe to assume that Arsenal are so shit that not even an injury to James can help them get 3 points? The other side of that, of course, is perhaps the injury wasn't quite serious enough.
Well, that's what I was going to say. Maybe it wasn't severe enough. Shall I tell you very quickly what happened?
Yes, please. And stop crinkling that bit of paper, whatever it is.
Oh, that's my cast type thing.
Oh, is it? Wearing. Oh, okay. Yeah, well, then I apologize. I thought you were playing with a sweet wrapper or something. So, no, that's fine.
No.
Just stop moving completely.
I'll just stay very, very still. So basically, I had to go on Friday to hospital anyway, because that's what my life is like. I was just having a routine scan on some important parts of my body. And that narrows sit down. So, I won't go into it. Some internal organs, they were just checking that they were the right shape or something like that.
Right.
And I left the hospital and my wife was in the car and she was like, oh, let's go and get a takeaway coffee from the coffee shop near here. I was like, brilliant. All right, we'll go and do that. So we went and we parked in like a little parking space next to a van. We went and got the coffee. We got back to the car. I couldn't get in the front seat of my car to drive it because the van was too close to me.
How did you get out in the first place?
Maybe the van wasn't there when I first parked.
Okay.
Actually.
Right.
So then I stood at the side and thought, rather than open my door and, you know, cause any problems with this van, I could see the driver in the van, and I was like, I'll just let him drive out. He was facing out of the car park space, whereas my car was facing in.
Yeah.
He had parked more adeptly. So he drove out the space. I went round. I opened my car door. And then, for reasons I don't understand to this day, he started reversing back into the space. And I was waving and shouting, being like, you're about to take off my car door, because he was reversing directly into it. And what I should have done, obviously, is just got out the way and let the car door perish. But what I did was, for some reason, I sort of put my arm between the van and the car door. And he reversed, continually to reverse, despite me banging on the back of the van, crushing my right arm between the van and the door. Which is weird, because my great aunt lost her arm in an accident where it getting crushed out of the side of a car. But
really?
My arm is intact.
You're not just making that bit up, no?
No, that's 100% true.
Wow.
It's actually, her situation was worse. She had her arm, she was on a bus and she had her arm out of the window and the bus swerved. and it got crushed between a bus and a lamppost.
Okay, so this van driver had no sensory perception whatsoever. You know, he couldn't see. He obviously couldn't hear.
He didn't look in his mirror.
He couldn't feel anything when you were banging on the van.
Yeah. So my arm, I mean, a questionable decision may be to sort of have put myself in harm's way, but I really thought he'd stop that van, and he really didn't. Mm. And my arm went very big and very sort of wonky looking, and I was like, as a man who's broken bones before, I was like, here we go.
Yeah, here we go again.
And the pain was very intense. You know, I mean, the screams of Bernd Leno were nothing compared to me on the floor in a car park in Boreham Wood.
Wow.
And I went back to the same hospital, and it transpired after a few scans. They were like, yeah, it's definitely broken. It's definitely broken. It isn't broken.
What the fuck sort of hospital is this? What kind of hospital is it? Like, you would expect some sort of, you know, what's the word? An assured decision. Oh, yeah, it's broken. We've scanned it. It's broken. And it's turned out to be not broken. What's wrong with them? Or their
machines?
It's
my fault. Because I said to the nurse, I was like, is it broken? She was like, how's your hand feel? And I was like, I've got pins and needles. I can't feel anything in my hand. She was like, that'll be broken then. So, in fairness to them, they were going on evidence. When they got the scan, they were like, oh, your bones are fine. It's just all your flesh. And they were like, that's fine. You can go home. But, I mean, I'm still annoyed. Basically, my arm really hurts, but it didn't break. And therefore, that's why we lost. And it is my fault.
Right. Okay. So not only did you get injured, you didn't get injured enough for us to win the game. And you're still in a great deal of pain and discomfort. And at the moment,
we need to find this van driver. It's like Final Destination.
Well, what happened to him? Did he drive off? Or
he drove straight off. Yeah.
He didn't get a number plate or anything like that?
We did get a number plate.
Right, okay.
Don't worry about that.
All you need now is a private investigator and a personal injury lawyer, and you'll be fine.
No, the thing is, what we need is we need him to get back. We need to get that man back, and this time he needs to properly kill me with
the
van.
Another option might be for us to get that van driver and for him to plough into the Southampton team bus, taking them off the motorway on their way. Oh, they'd be going individually. Anyway, I don't know. Run over a few of their players, spare you some of the pain, and maybe we might have a chance on Thursday. But look, a series of unfortunate events.
But don't worry, because the next day I got to cheer myself up by going to watch the mighty Arsenal in action at Brighton.
Is there an edict from on high that anybody who is involved in covering a game, whether as a journalist or a commentator or a pundit, must speak about how privileged they are to be there?
We do get a sheet that tells us that there are certain things we have to do, and that's one of the things on the list, yeah. You also have to tweet a picture of you in a mask at the ground. That's also obligatory.
Wow.
And then you also have to... I'm joking, by the way. No, this is true.
Oh, okay. So, it just wouldn't surprise me.
Yeah. No, I recognise that there are patterns of behaviour across journalists.
Okay.
But, I mean, to be honest, you do feel fortunate, but then you're also like, this is very weird. I mean, Brighton, it was it's the first game I've been to, and it was a really impressive, like, set up, you know, like you got there in your car, they took your temperature while you're in your car, they you know, it was all it was very like sort of conveyor belt, you know, park here, do this, walk here. It was super controlled, super efficient.
Right.
But also by that token, I mean a completely alien experience.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, look, what wasn't an alien experience was Arsenal losing a game away from home. That was a habit we'd sort of gotten out of under Mikel Arteta, but it came back with a vengeance on Saturday against Brighton. 3 o'clock kickoff. There's our little bit of trivia. Who's the first team ever to lose a game when a game has been broadcast at 3 p.m. live in the UK on television? Who could it be? It could only be us.
It
could only be us. So look, let's go into it and let's talk a little bit about this game and about what sort of a team Mikel Arteta picked. I mean, when you looked at it, did you have any particular issues? Were there things that stood out to you as surprising? Certainly the inclusion of Bukayo Saka in midfield was a very interesting one for me. and remains an interesting one, because I think we have this notion that with Saka, you know, we can see a place for him in the team on the left-hand side of the attack, and a very good place for him there. And then we think about, well, what happens with Aubameyang? What happens with Martinelli? And we'll come to some of those decisions. But this is another little string to his bow that we weren't necessarily sure that he had. And I thought it worked quite well in the opening part of the game.
Yeah, I think they experimented with it in those friendly games. He played a few minutes in that position there. I mean, I actually thought that Arsenal's lineup was pretty interesting and started pretty well. I mean, I know there won't be much appetite to hear that given the result, but I thought the first 10 minutes, a bit like the Man City game, was sort of the most encouraging bit. And I actually thought there were sort of some quite interesting tactical developments. You know, Arteta really did change up what he was doing by, you know, he always plays with like a kind of number 10, be that an Ozil or a Willock the other night, but he didn't. He had sort of two central midfielders in Ceballos and Saka either side of Guendouzi, and Saka was doing this sort of interesting inside-out thing where he was sort of central midfielder, but he could go wide, meaning Aubameyang could cut in, and Bellerin was doing that sort of Man City-esque right-back thing.
Very, very tucked in, didn't he?
Yeah, it was kind of in possession. It was kind of a 3-3-4 almost. So Kolasinac was super deep, almost a third centre back. Bellerin was kind of a third central midfielder, and then Saka could kind of overlap wide. And you know, it was interesting because that is sort of a lot of the tricks Man City play. You know, De Bruyne plays that kind of role that Saka was doing, albeit on the opposite side. Kyle Walker plays that right back role. I was watching it and thinking, oh, this is the next evolution here. This is where we're going with this. And obviously, it didn't sustain, and the performance wasn't good at all, really, after the first 15 minutes.
Yeah, look, I mean, we hit the bar, and we can talk about fine margins and everything else, and if Saka's shot goes in, maybe it changes the story of the game. You know, you go a goal up and maybe you're filled with confidence. To me, it sometimes feels like the longer we go without scoring, the more worried we become or the more inhibited we become in terms of our own performance. And there were some tight situations. You think about the great Saka pass through to Aubameyang, where he was just, you know, his toe was offside, basically. And there were moments where it looked like it was happening, but, you know, there just wasn't any kind of consistency or fluidity to the way that we played. Brighton kind of figured us out. That guy in the midfield was allowed foul with gay abandon, if you like. Bissouma, was that his name? Someone told me on Twitter that Martin Keown picked him as his man of the match.
Yeah, that's true.
And I thought, that's the most perfect thing I've ever heard of, because Keown would have looked at that performance from Bissouma and just marveled at the ability he had to make fouls and not get booked. I mean, it was crazy. I mean, genuinely, like, imagine how much Keown would have loved a game in which he could go and just career around the pitch and foul people and disrupt play and break up play. And I'm not being critical of the player, by the way. I'm absolutely not being critical of him for doing that. And, you know, I would pay good money for an Arsenal player to be able to do that. And that might be a discussion we have a little bit later on in the podcast. You know, it's down to the refereeing and the officiating and everything else. But, you know, it was quite a marvel to see a player just be able to do that without even a word from the referee. There wasn't even a ticking off from Martin Atkinson.
Yeah, really interesting. It did feel a bit like home advantage, even though there were no fans to kind of sway the referee's opinion. It was incredible what he got away with. I think from Brighton's point of view, you know, maybe he was man of the match. He was certainly disruptive. And it was, kind of flabbergasting that he didn't, you know, pick up a booking much, much earlier. Nevertheless, after that first 15 minutes, I mean, Arsenal, you make a good point about us not scoring. And I do think that, you know, it's not an original or particularly interesting observation to say that Arsenal have problems defensively and can be sloppy and vulnerable at set pieces. But I do think that it's going forward and it's the lack of clear chances we create that's maybe more concerning.
Well, I think the other thing to note as well, and I've noticed this more than once, and, you know, I could be completely wrong, but it feels like this is a true thing to me, that after a team realises that Arsenal are a bit toothless, they start to apply a bit more pressure on us. They start to play higher up the pitch. They start to press us higher up the pitch, and we're not, you know, particularly well able to cope with that. I think when we can compress the opposition, when we can play more of the game in their half, there is a bit more about us from an attacking point of view. But I think that the big issue for me is midfield. We just do not have a midfield worth talking about. You know, that they're... The qualities of the players that we have in there do not allow us to control football games. And the age-old debate about Aubameyang on the left, I think, is in some way predicated from the fact that we have a central midfield that just doesn't create, doesn't score, doesn't protect our defence well enough. You know, in order to have any kind of a platform in a game, you need players in there who can do multiple things, you know, and we don't have players who can do that. And I'm not being critical of Saka, for example. You know, he is a player who's got a lot to his game, whether it's wide, whether he's playing in that central area. But I worry about Guendouzi, even though I thought, you know, he was pretty tidy in general on the ball. I think Ceballos also was pretty tidy on the ball, but like... There's no pace in that midfield. There's no athleticism in that midfield. There's no creativity in that midfield. There's no aggression in that midfield. There's no passing range really in that midfield. I know, they're tidy enough on the ball, but they're not. They're not penetrative. They're not creative. And I think something I pointed out in the blog the other day was that all of our central midfielders this season, I don't include Mesut Ozil in this because I think of him more as an attacking midfield player, have one Premier League goal between them the entire season. So this requires us to have goal threats from other areas of the pitch and requires us to think, okay, well, we could play Aubameyang centrally, but we're going to have to play a centre forward as well because we need a centre forward. So we pick Lacazette because Nketiah played the other night. Lacazette, a player, hasn't scored an away goal for well over a year. I think it was February 2019 since he last scored away from home. So there's a lot of problems in this team, but I really feel like the heart of our engine room, if you like, is a major, major part of what's wrong.
Yeah, definitely. And not that he's the perfect solution by any means, but Granit Xhaka was a very important player for Mikel Arteta prior to the interruption of football. And I think losing him as early as we did in the return is clearly a problem.
Isn't that sort of also illustrative of the wider issues that we have in that area of the pitch? And, you know, I don't really dislike Granit Xhaka. I think he's a player who's got some limitations, but I can also see the qualities that he has. But if he, when you look at the lineup of central midfielders that we have, is, I think, by far the most important to provide any kind of structure to our midfield, that tells me that there's a problem beyond, you know, simply the personnel, if you like.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, I think Arteta has been unfortunate in that he doesn't have Xhaka, he doesn't have Torreira. Yeah. Again, I'm not sure that those are perfect players to fix this issue. I mean, if you look at Manchester United, and they are looking now at dovetailing Fernandes with Pogba, I mean, those two players are on a level that none of the Arsenal midfielders are close to, I would suggest. And you can say Guendouzi and Ceballos look tidy, but it's kind of the problem as much as anything with them is that they always do look relatively tidy, but don't always feel like they're affecting games dramatically.
Yeah, there's an element of, you know, good stats, good-looking stats. And you wonder, I mean, what was Guendouzi in terms of his passing? Let me get it up here. He was 92.9%, you know, 39 out of 42 passes. And let's see here with Ceballos. Why isn't my thing doing fucking iPad? Ceballos, you know, 32 out of 39, so 82%. So not that safe, but probably tried a couple more risky passes than Guendouzi did. And look, I feel for Arteta. He doesn't have a great deal to work with in there. He may have even less to work with on Thursday night because Guendouzi could be facing a three-game ban.
Yeah, it's a massive problem, and it's a huge area of concern. I mean, you know, Arsenal, it's also an area with big questions, because, you know, what do Arsenal decide on Ceballos in the next 24 hours?
Mm.
You know, it's... I mean, it feels remiss to not say, well, look, obviously there are problems at centre-half, obviously there are problems in attack, but I do think that the hub of your team is your central midfield, isn't it? Mm. And when we think about the great Arsenal teams that we've been fortunate enough to watch in the past, so often it was the central midfield that was kind of the heartbeat of those teams.
Yeah, and look, you know, this is an area of the pitch which has been in need of... we've needed to do something there for a long time, and it's not as if we haven't tried. You know, Xhaka came in for big money. Lucas Torreira came in. Guendouzi was, you know, I think a relatively cheap option who proved himself to be more useful than people thought, or certainly they might have expected in the early part of his Arsenal career. But, you know, unless we sort out this area of the pitch with the kind of players who can thrive in the Premier League, we're going to continue to struggle. But look, maybe we can have that debate another day. Let's talk about Bernd Leno, and let's talk about the challenge by Neil Maupay. I assume that if the screams were as visible as they were on TV, they were even more so within the ground itself.
Yes, that is a kind of unsettling element of these fanless games, is that when a player is in that much discomfort, it's very, very clear. And it was very alarming. I mean, genuinely, from some of the reactions of some of the players, given that we didn't have the benefit of replay straight away, I thought it might be one of those situations where his leg was back to front. I mean, that people had their head in their hands kind of thing. And I think that was because they were clearly upset and shocked by how much pain he was in. Although maybe we'll return to this. I'm not sure if that level of upset was made particularly evident.
Yeah.
If you see what I mean.
No, I do see what you mean. And that is certainly something we will come back to. And I think we might do that in part two, because we've got a couple of questions about that. But the challenge itself, you know, it's one of those, and we've had this discussion before, haven't we? We've talked about how snide it is, how dangerous it can be. Most of the time, 99.9% of the time, Bernd Leno lands absolutely fine, and he gets a free kick because it's clear what has happened there. What did happen, as far as I can tell and as far as I can see, and you can correct me if I'm wrong here, is that Maupay knew that Leno was going to catch the ball. He was near the edge of his box. He wanted to give him a little nudge so he would land outside the box, therefore getting a free kick for his team. And the very first thing that Maupay does when Leno lands outside the box is point and say, look, he's outside the box, free kick, we should get a free kick. And then the screams start and he sort of melts away into the background. The whole point of whether or not he meant to hurt him or whether he meant for an injury to happen, to me, is completely, what's the word? It's irrelevant. That's the word I was looking for. It's absolutely irrelevant. When you carry out a foul like that on a player, you run a risk of them suffering a serious injury. We saw it with Arnautovic when he did exactly the same to Mathieu Debuchy, gave him a shoulder in the back while both his feet were off the air. Debuchy crashes into the advertising hoardings, dislocates his shoulder, I think just weeks after coming back from a knee or an ankle ligament injury. And that was basically Debuchy's Arsenal career done and dusted. It was over for him. He never recovered from that. There was one, I think, with Alexis getting pushed down a camera hole, or whatever the fuck you call them, at Carrow Road against Norwich. I think Koscielny suffered a similar kind of incident last season as well. Again, with his back to goal or shepherding a ball out and off balance, he gets a shove and people go, ah, it's nothing, it's a contact sport, blah, 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 blah. But this is what can happen. This is what can happen when you do that. The injury to Leno is 100% caused by that tiny little nudge. You might call it irrelevant or insignificant or just a coming together, whatever you want to do. But if he doesn't do that, Leno lands fine and Arsenal will have a goalkeeper who's not going to be out of action for 9 months. And I'm tired of that kind of foul being excused. And I'm also tired of there not being sufficient rules in place for football to deal with those kind of incidents. Because in rugby, there's a very clear rule, and rugby is a game where men smash into each other fucking head first all day long. They fucking smash each other. But there is a rule that if you tackle a player while he's in the air, while his feet are off the ground, it is recognized as being extremely dangerous. And if there is no intent to get the ball with that tackle, then you get sent off. You get a red card in rugby for that. Why is there no similar rule in football? Why is it just one of those things that's glossed over? It's like, it's just a bit unfortunate.
Well, I think if he had rugby tackled him in midair, he would have been sent off. Let's be clear about that.
Sure, but it's levels. It's the same. You know, you can't do a rugby tackle unless you're Matteo Guendouzi, which he did earlier in the season. But, you know, and he got booked for it and everything else. But it's about the player's feet or the player being in the air and being off balance and the foul designed to throw that player further off balance. Like I said, most of the time he'll be fine. He'll just stumble and fall and everything else. But, you know, it can cause serious injury, as it appears to have done with Leno.
I guess. I think I'm slightly less exercised about it, personally. I sort of feel like a really good tackle can cause a serious injury. Do you know what I mean? It's like anything is prone to an accident. And I think that the Debussy and Alexis situations, for me, are much more grave because they are, when a player is off the pitch, pushing them, you know, into another area or off, you know, off the side of the pitch. I think that is really awful. With the Mope thing, I was sort of thinking, I was genuinely thinking, like, if it's a home striker, if it's Lacazette or Aubameyang and they're sort of closing down a goalkeeper, and although in slow motion replay, yeah, clearly he takes the ball a long way before, don't you actually sort of want your striker to not pull out of stuff?
If he's going for the ball, absolutely. But he wasn't going for the ball. He knew Leno had the ball in his hands. It was not a challenge in which he went for the ball. So
it's definitely cynical. I mean, I think you're right. He's either playing for a handball or he's playing for Leno to drop it in the collision, and somehow he gets away with it and it's not given as a free kick.
Yeah.
I think the officiating was really bad on the day.
I agree.
But in this instance, it's the law that's the ass.
Well, that's my point. And we have VAR, we have technology in which that incident could have been reviewed very, very quickly to show that Mope had A, no intention of playing the ball, and B, he nudged the goalkeeper while his feet were in the air. Therefore, it's reckless. It's causing it's endangering an opponent. You know, it's not like he's pushing him into the stands or onto some spikes or railings, but you know, he's off balance, and the consequence of that is him landing in a way which hyperextends his knee. And I think the fear is that Leno has suffered an ACL rupture. We have to wait for some confirmation. It normally takes a couple of days. Fingers crossed that's not the case. But, you know, the consequences of that one action for Arsenal are, A, we lose Leno, who's our best player, one of our best players. B, we've got to use our backup goalkeeper now for the rest of this season, and hopefully Emi Martinez can step up. C, it might mean we have to spend money on a goalkeeper in the summer if the injury is long-term. You know, it throws another sort of complication into our transfer business, whatever that is, you know. And what happens to Mope? Nothing.
Well, no, nothing. And that is the law of not being correct, I would say. You know, if something is genuinely not an attempt to win the ball, I think that's clearly worse than, I mean, Lacazette went in on the goalkeeper, didn't he, in the second half. And I think the difference, I haven't seen a replay of that one, but the difference, by all accounts, was that it seemed that the ball was there to be won.
Yeah, he went sliding in.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, still dangerous. And he was booked, right? Which I think is correct. But yeah, I mean, look, I feel desperately sorry for Leno. I feel desperately sorry for him because he's had a nightmare of a season in terms of what he's had to face, but he's come out of it with enormous credit. I do think there is a case to be made that he has been our best player this season. I think it's between him and Aubameyang, clearly, but he has been brilliant on so many occasions. and we're going to miss him enormously. I don't mean that necessarily as a slight on Emi Martinez, but I just think Leno's been outstanding. And if it is an ACL injury and no other ligaments are damaged, I think he's actually done fairly well, because from what a couple of people said, like, that could be a multiple ligament injury to properly hyperextend your knee in that way. Even so, it's clearly awful.
Yeah.
And, we'll get on to the manager, but I have to say, whatever you make of his decisions and his management, I think he has been very unlucky in his first two games.
Not just in the first two games, and this isn't to make excuses for him, but I think he's been really, really unlucky since he arrived, because he's lost players to injury. You know, you think about Callum Chambers getting an injury, a cruciate ligament injury as well. Lucas Torreira, I'm pretty sure there's been another one, but then, you know, you come back, you lose Granit Xhaka inside a couple of minutes, you lose Pablo Marie inside 20 minutes, you lose your goalkeeper. I think he really has been unlucky. Arsenal have been unlucky. The only luck we've had is bad luck. I don't know what to say. Fingers crossed for Leno, but it's, you know, I just find it really...
Good.
No, it doesn't look good, but I find it really annoying, really, really annoying. That we lose a player in those circumstances, because it is so, so unnecessary. The reaction of the Arsenal players and everything else we'll come to in part two. So let's go on to...
Just to say briefly on that, I did love Leno's reaction.
Oh, yeah. Leno, like, take your fucking cue from Leno, guys. Take your cue from him, because he knew what happened and he was furious about it, and the Arsenal players didn't really show any of that until after the game. Again, we'll come back to that. Let's talk about the goals, and then we can talk about the manager and the substitutions and the changes and those kind of things. So Nicolas Pepe had a quiet day overall, but he picked up a pass. I think it was from Saka. Was he just inside the box or just outside the box? And, you know, what a finish. What an incredible finish from Nicolas Pepe. I mean, that's what you want to see more of from him. And I realize there are other aspects to why we don't quite get as much from him as we might do. But that was a real piece of individual quality.
Yeah, it was. It reminded me, obviously, of his goal against West Ham. Just a brilliant strike. I mean, the way it dips in under the far corner. I mean, he had a really weird game in some ways, because I know people say Bellerin doesn't support him enough and doesn't run outside him, but I don't think there's any way you could watch this game and not think that that's what Bellerin was under instruction to do. I mean, he was really tucked in narrow. And I think that was quite deliberate. I think that the idea was to isolate Pepe one versus one against 6'6" Dan Burn and run him, which worked to an extent. I mean, Burn was quite clever. He committed quite a few fouls on Pepe to sort of stop him getting away. I mean, Brighton were, you know, very physical, and they were happy to commit fouls when they needed to in order to slow Arsenal down. But Pepe, you know, he didn't get into the game a great deal, but that was an example of what he can do.
Okay, I mean, I take your point about Bellerin and what he was instructed to do, but do you feel like with that kind of instruction, it still leaves Pepe quite isolated and maybe not getting on the ball as much as we would want him to?
Yeah, I mean, it does. What I noticed was it meant that whoever was playing left wing for Brighton, and I'm not sure it was, I think it might have been Aaron Moy in the first half.
And they brought on March.
Because Moy had been booked, that's right. So when Bellerin went infield, Moy went with him. And all that meant was that it meant every time Pepe was available, was one versus one with Burn. And I actually would argue that the bigger problem was that Arsenal didn't get the ball to him. Because I think I would back Pepe against Burn 8 times out of 10. And I think that the team was set up to facilitate that, but he didn't get on the ball. I know that, you know, fine, take Bellerin down there with him, but he's going to take Moy with him as well.
It is weird, though, because you look at... I'm just looking at the passes. Like, from the time he scored the goal until the time he was taken off, he received 3 passes.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, which is, it's crazy. He's playing against a left back who's on a yellow card.
I think that the right-hand side was dysfunctional. I think we didn't get him on the ball. I think Bellerin wasn't particularly great in that role. It's not a role that he's played loads of. And I also think that Ceballos was our kind of right-sided central midfield player. And I just think that's not his side. I mean, one of the issues with this Arsenal midfield, I thought on Saturday, was that in Guendouzi, Saka and Ceballos, and I think Tim Stillman tweeted about this, you've got three players who want to be in the inside left channel, really. Like, that's where they're all more comfortable. And the Arsenal didn't look to use the right-hand side enough. I also think Lacazette was pulling into that channel but didn't have the best game. I mean, as he tends to not away from home. So, yeah, it is an odd one. And I do accept that it looks like Pepe is left with an enormous amount to do. The funny thing is, in this particular match, in this particular 1v1, I would have absolutely backed him to be able to do it. And when he got the ball, he was dangerous. I just don't think we spread the play and spread the play. I don't think we did it well enough. And I don't think we found him in space enough.
Yeah, I mean, I think part of that, and we'll come to it now in a moment, is, you know, the substitutions. I think there was Ceballos was absolutely knackered. I mean, he's not the quickest anyway. But there was, you know, there were times you're looking at him and you're going, are you wearing fucking lead boots, man? You know, he just does not move quickly. And look, he played basically the whole game against Manchester City and everything else. And, I realized that perhaps the options we have are imperfect. But, you know, after 3 months without football, you've got to assess properly the physical capabilities of the players. And maybe if somebody isn't quite technically as secure as Ceballos, but can give you more physically, it offsets that, particularly when you're playing against a team who are also going to be suffering, you know, physically. So that might have been something Arteta could have done a bit earlier. Their first goal, 2v1 versus a corner, I've watched it again and again, and it's difficult to see exactly who should be with Ceballos out there, but I think it's Pepe. And he drifts off centrally. But, you know, to end up with just 2v1 on a corner like that is absolutely ridiculous.
Especially given that it was quite clear, I think, from early on that set pieces probably were the biggest threat to us on the day.
Yeah, I mean, and the point, just to sort of cut across you, sorry, is that, you know, when it comes to set pieces, it's not just the ball being delivered in the box that you have to be aware of, you know? It's easy to look at Brighton and say, look at all these big guys that they can put in our box, and they have a line of four and they're all standing there. But, you know, a set piece isn't just about the ball coming into your box. It's how you're set up from each one to make sure something like that doesn't develop.
Yeah, it's basics, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's real basics. And I think that played into Arteta's frustration at full time, you know, speaking about competing and being switched on, essentially. Arsenal weren't switched on enough and they were punished. I mean, you know, it's a scrappy goal once it goes into the box, but you're absolutely right. It's the ease with which it goes into the box that's our undoing.
The winner?
Yeah, the winner, I need to have a look at it again, actually. I'm just loading it up now. I think people will forgive me. I haven't wanted to watch it. Brighton brought on a player, McAllister, who is a very, very tidy, talented player, and he was involved. I mean, my first reaction when I saw it was, and maybe this is wrong, but I saw it and thought, that's a really good goal.
It was smart, because I think if you look at it again, what's really clever, and I'm not here to sort of blow smoke up the arse of the opposition, is the movement of the two forwards. Is it Connolly?
The step over.
Is it Connolly who plays the little dink or the little...
Yeah, it's McAllister into Connolly, and Mope has dummied it and goes around the outside.
Yeah, but if you look at the movement of the two strikers, you know, it looks as if our central defender should have them covered. But if you look at it, that one runs off the other one, so the two central defenders are... So he dummies it, and that guy flicks it around the corner, and then...
I mean, Mustafi does... I mean, listen, Mustafi's been, the in some ways the least of our problems in these two games, but he does get properly bamboozled there by that movement.
He does. I've got nothing more to say about Mustafi that I've, you know, haven't already said. I just don't see the point. He's been fine, but, you know, there are moments where he gets exposed, and that was one of them. I do think as well that when Mikel Arteta talked about the manner of the goals, we didn't compete properly with either of the goals. I think he might think that his central midfielders could have done more. I think Guendouzi's effort to close down the original pass is half-hearted, to say the least. I mean, he played nominally as our defensive midfielder and didn't make a single tackle, you know? Yeah. And look, I don't... I'm not saying I blame him, per se. That's kind of not his game. It's not what he does. He's not a tackler or an interceptor, really. But it's a problem, you know? And look, again, did he play the whole game against Man City, Guendouzi? Or he played a significant chunk of it anyway?
Yeah, I mean, look, tackles aren't the be-all and end-all. Gilberto Silva didn't always put in crunching challenges, did he? But it's about being smart. And when you look at the replay, I'm watching it again and again now. I don't know why, it's sort of hypnotic. But when it is that guy, McAllister, who picks it up in midfield, Guendouzi's some way off him. I think Reece Nelson's the closest player. He could probably do more. Yeah. Guendouzi could certainly do more.
Yeah.
I think, you know, maybe that's Joe Willock inside. I'm not sure who could do more. There's just too much space to play that pass into such a dangerous position on the edge of the 18-yard box. And yeah, sure, from there, Brighton do well. It's the little Giroud flick and finish. But, Mustafi won't be happy with his contribution in that. And I think you could see in Arteta post-match that he was really, really unhappy with the nature of the concession of the lead.
Of course. I mean, look...
It would be weird if he wasn't.
Yeah, of course. Conceding a goal at that point of any game, or conceding a goal that loses you the game at that point is, you know, it's like a knife in the guts. However way you want to compartmentalise what's going on this season, and however sanguine you might be about where we are and what we're doing and everything that's gone on, it's still like a kick in the bollocks when you concede a goal like that.
Should we still have been playing, by the way? I'm just looking at it now, and it's 94 minutes and 28 seconds. I mean...
Was there a stoppage or something like that?
Was there a stoppage? I can't remember.
I can't quite remember, but...
I'm not looking for excuses.
Do you know who went down? It was the dude who fucking got fouled, or who committed all the fouls. It was Bissouma, who basically just sat down on the pitch... And wasted a big chunk of the injury time, which then didn't really get added on because of the change that they made and also the celebration of the goal. I feel like we should have been able to take the corner, but you know, that's not our big problem.
Absolutely, yeah. I remember now, Bissouma. Yeah, he was cramping from a little bit earlier than that, sort of going down routinely. I mean, you never know in a situation like that. Is it about the clock?
But yeah. Look, I think any person listening to this podcast, just go out in the street and spend 90 minutes kicking people.
Yeah,
and you'll have to sit down yourself.
You will feel that in the thighs.
You'll start cramping up eventually. Let's talk substitutions, James. And it's been a discussion that we've had more than once about Mikel Arteta since he took over, with all the applicable caveats in, you know, that he's a rookie manager and learning his trade and all those things. I think people can recognize that. But, you know, if you're having this discussion on a semi-consistent basis, it suggests that there is, you know, room for improvement. And I think Arteta would probably recognize that himself. If he's looking to maintain high standards from his players, he'll want those high standards to be applied to himself, or expect them to be applied to himself as well. Substitutions, I feel, in the time that he's been with us, have been a weakness. Is that, you know, I don't want to be overly critical, but I think it's fair to say that there are things, you know, he's good at and things which he's not quite as good at. And this is certainly one of them. I think that was summed up by what happened with the first change, with they were going to bring Eddie Nketiah on and also Kieran Tierney on. And the reason that didn't happen, my understanding is that it was on our side. It wasn't on the official side. So, you know, even something as basic as that, you know, is an area that we can improve on.
Yeah, and look, that was a big problem because it meant that the final change, if they wanted to bring Tierney on, that had to be it. You know, they had to make all their changes at the same time. They had a third opportunity. And it was a bizarre situation to watch unfold. I mean, Tierney was absolutely ready to come on. And seemed bemused about as to why he couldn't. It's obviously disappointing to know that the protocol wasn't followed. Do you know, is the protocol more complex at the moment than normal? Like, are there, like, do you have to tick forms saying he hasn't got a temperature or something?
I don't know. I don't think so. I think it's just the standard thing. You have to fill out some paperwork and give it to the fourth official and what have you. So
that's really frustrating. But I think that is sort of almost, I mean, that's a kind of side note. I think in terms of Arteta's decision-making, I think you're right. I think substitutions are an area of weakness. And that's inevitable, I guess, that there will be those areas of weakness in such an inexperienced manager. But that's seemingly one. And it does matter, particularly at the moment when you're able to change quite so many players. You know, you want that to be with a positive effect.
Yeah, I mean, would you have done anything differently to what he did? I mean, he brought Nketiah on for Lacazette, which basically kind of like for like, when he could possibly have, let's say, brought Lacazette off and put Martinelli on the left-hand side and moved Aubameyang into the centre.
He could have done that. I mean, it's difficult to know. I mean, we've got a couple of questions about Martinelli and why he's not been involved, which we'll come round to. I have the slight hunch that he sort of feels Aubameyang and Martinelli offer you very similar things, and he was looking for some of those more Lacazette-like qualities, and that's where he sees Nketiah as more analogous. I'm just looking. I mean, he did that on 78 minutes. I think. Again, he's unlucky because he had to use a substitution for injury in the first half with Martinez. The three changes at 87 minutes, is it 1-1 at that point?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, they felt to me like they weren't even really substitutions to go and win the game, but more just like, here's some more minutes for these players.
Here's some fresh legs in the final few minutes. Yeah. And
maybe that's a mistake. Like, maybe he should have been thinking, What can I do to improve this situation? What can I do to push on? Because Tierney, as a left winger, for example, is not a particularly progressive attacking change, is it?
Not really. I mean, I suppose the idea was to get him on the left wing and put some crosses in, you know, because he's good at that. He can deliver well into the box. We've seen that this season. But, you know, again, could Tierney not have come on for Kolasinac and you find space for Martinelli or what have you. You look at, you know, the 87-minute changes. How Ceballos lasted 87 minutes, I will never know. You know, and again, I accept that his options are limited. He could have put on Joe Willock earlier, or he could have put on Ainsley Maitland-Niles in midfield, about whom he had some very positive things to say before the game. But, you know, it's sort of recognising where his team is struggling and addressing those issues in-game.
Yeah, it's game management, isn't it? And it's being able to affect change.
Yeah.
I don't necessarily feel that he's particularly strong in that area right now. The only caveat I would offer to that is we're all saying Martinelli because Martinelli didn't play. But when you look at that bench, it's not massively strong. I would argue.
No, I wouldn't disagree with that. I wouldn't disagree with that at all. Like I said, the options are not particularly brilliant. And, I'm really wondering what he's going to do if Guendouzi is banned for Thursday. And that would mean he'd be also banned for the Sheffield United FA Cup game and the home game against Norwich.
Yeah.
And we're without Granit Xhaka. We won't have Lucas Torreira. You know, the latest medical update from the medical team on the official site was that he's looking to return to full training in 2 to 3 weeks. That's not a guy who's going to necessarily be ready to play in 2 to 3 weeks. You know, it feels like it's next season for Lucas Torreira, you know, based on how much time there is left in this particular campaign. Mm-hmm. Maybe I'm wrong, but, you know, we'll wait and see. So, you know, what sort of a midfield is he going to fashion out of Ceballos, who's played two games and been, you know, looked very leggy and didn't look particularly good? He's got Joe Willock. He's got Saka. He's got Ainsley Maitland-Niles. And then what?
Well, I think we're at the point where he's got to give Ainsley Maitland-Niles a game in there. I mean, I wouldn't read too much into what Arteta said about him. I mean, certainly there has been a kind of rapprochement between them. Certainly they're on better terms, and Ainsley is considered for selection at this stage, and Arteta thinks his attitude is improved. I don't think he's, you know, suddenly going to be the next Arsenal captain or anything like it. I think there's still a big chance that he might be on his way come the summer. But right now, given the lack of qualities we have in central midfield, given the injury problems we face, given the fact that we've tried other stuff and it hasn't worked, I think he has to be worth a go at this stage. And, you know, he had his shot at right back. It's worth remembering, he didn't play badly at right back, particularly under Mikel Arteta. He was actually fairly decent. The issue was simply that he didn't want to continue playing there. And I think if he does want to play higher up the pitch, if he does want to play in midfield, I mean, we go to Southampton next. Am I right in thinking that that's actually where one of Maitland-Niles' best Arsenal performances did come as a central midfielder, in that cup win where Danny Welbeck scored a couple, maybe, and Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain played central midfield.
It was a big win
in the FA Cup. Maybe there'll be another chance for him there, because, I mean, look, I just think if you go with Ceballos, you're putting yourself almost at a disadvantage in terms of legs and athleticism immediately. So anyone you've got who can counteract that or bring some dynamism to the midfield, I think has to be considered.
Yeah, and of course, there's the number 10 that we've kind of all forgotten about.
Talk about that subs bench. I mean, I genuinely forgot that he was there when I said that that was a very weak bench. And I'll tell you part of the reason I forgot. I mean, I know reading anything into body language is a dangerous game, but his body language at Brighton was not the body language of someone who was particularly confident he was going to be involved at any point.
Right. Yeah. I did see him go out to warm up at one point. They showed him on the TV going out to warm up. But, you know, look, needs must. You know, we're in a difficult position, and, you know, can make all the cases about being away from home. And look, I'm not necessarily convinced that Mesut Ozil is anything like the kind of player that we would like him to be, or anything like the kind of player he used to be, not by a long way. But, you know, what else is there when we're going to Southampton and we might have, you know, just kids to choose from? You've got to get some experience and also, you know, some ability on the ball. So maybe this could be his Mustafi-esque redemption for the last few games.
The cycles are getting quicker, aren't they? In terms of sort of he's out and then he's in. I mean, it used to be sort of over a period of months and now it's days.
Yeah. Well, look, there we are. Anything else from this? Anything else you think we might have learned or that we need to discuss in this part of the show? Other than to just sort of say again that it was a very, very disappointing result. And even if you're like I said, fairly sanguine about what's going on, to go and lose to Brighton for the second time this season is very disappointing.
Yeah, I mean, the table is pretty sobering right now. I don't know if you sort of caught sight of it yesterday, but I believe we're in 10th now. We've got a goal difference of 0. We are very much a mid-table team this season.
Yeah.
And it's not like an outlier that we're there. It's what all the underlying metrics and things like that suggest we should be. It is sobering. I mean, I think Man City, you know, we could all look at that and go, well, that's Man City. Do you know what I mean? I mean, we could all sort of isolate that game to an extent. But Brighton had not won a match this calendar year in the Premier League. Go on.
No, I was just going to say, we hadn't, you know, until this week, we hadn't lost a game in the Premier League this year, and Brighton hadn't won a game. I mean, is there a better team to face if you're Brighton than Arsenal?
Possibly not. But yeah, it was quite sobering. And I sort of also think, looking at that table and looking at the amount of teams in between us and sort of those European places, and looking at the fact that, like, some of them won, like Wolves, and, you know, we might have a question about this, but I'm kind of very close to sort of writing it off.
The season?
Yeah.
Our chances of, like, achieving anything?
Yeah,
me too. I'm, like, there's the realistic part of my brain and the kind of gut-feeling part of my brain is, like, this has been over for a while. This is a season I really, really want to see the back of. I think, you know, we're struggling for all kinds of reasons that we don't need to go into, that we've discussed many, many times. You know, a lot of what's happening is a consequence of what's come before Mikel Arteta, but, you know, Arteta has to obviously take some responsibility for what we've done on the pitch against Brighton and everything else. And then there's the other kind of little sneaky part of my head that goes, well, you know, we could win the FA Cup and get back into Europe that way. And then it's like, shut up. You shut up, you stupid brain. But I can't help thinking that either, you know? It's weird.
Well, also, experience has kind of taught us that, because there were so many times under Arsene Wenger when it looked like that door was closed and then we would somehow sort of sneak in. But I do get the sense that this group of players is a slightly different matter, and that the season is a slightly different matter.
There are issues that we're going to go into in part two, because we do have some good questions. So look, let's take a break and we will come back with your questions and more in part two right after this.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome back to the Arsecast Extra. This is part two of the show where we answer questions that you send to us on Twitter at GunnarBlog and at ArseBlog on the ArseBlog Facebook page, facebook.com/TheArseBlog, and also on the ArseBlog Discord server, which you get access to if you are an ArseBlog member on Patreon. I just want to start with this one from Facebook, from Christopher Howard Moon Smith. There's a name. Anyway, he said, why am I seeing so much praise for Ceballos' reverse nutmeg on Lacazette? If Lacazette hadn't lifted up at precisely the right moment, it would have been the shittest pass of the entire game straight into his teammate's arse, which I thought was quite funny.
I don't know. Good question. Why are we really any praise of Ceballos?
Yeah.
Very good question.
Anyway, look, let's start with a more interesting question, and certainly one that a lot of people have asked. Again, from the Discord, this is from Marin17, who says, there's clearly something wrong with the mentality of these players. The game was 1-1 and the players looked absolutely content with it. Nobody seemed really upset about Leno's injury, apart from Leno. Guendouzi's antics after the game don't count. What do you think we need to do to instill some fighting spirit into these players? And also from the Discord, we have one from, oh gosh, it didn't copy the name across. Let me see if I can get it here. I should have this. I can't find it anywhere. Oh, it's from Ron Snooder, who says, other than a complete 100% overhaul of the players, how do you fix or at least address the issue of nobody going to Leno's aid? How do you instill that camaraderie or that kind of fight? Is it trained or is it bought? Does it speak to a lack of togetherness in the squad?
How do we get some fight? We buy Bissouma from Brighton and just get him to run around kicking everyone. I don't know. It did trouble me slightly, I have to say. I really, really, as I said in part one, enjoyed Leno's reaction, and I liked that he was sort of, you know, angry, and that anger was sort of channeled in a confrontational way. And it does bother me that there wasn't anyone kind of stepping in there. I think actually that is another instance where you really felt the absence of someone like Granit Xhaka. And even though, you know, he has his critics, I suspect that's a conversation he would have been involved in. You know, the captain out there is Aubameyang. It's just not him, is it? To kind of step up in that way and be confrontational. That is not his character. It's not his persona. It's not the type of leader he is. You do need that in a team. and it bothers me. I mean, if you think, you know, we spoke about Martin Keown earlier, imagine his response, you know?
Absolutely. I mean, look, it's kind of easy to say, well, back in my day, back in the old days, if that had happened, you know, but really, if that had happened, you know, not too long ago, Mope would have got smashed. Next time he went for the ball, he would have got clattered. And I don't mean like, you know, he would have got a dig in the head or whatever, but he would certainly have been left under no illusions as to what every single Arsenal player on that pitch thought of him and was willing to do to him. Like, you know,
yeah,
it is a difficult one. I know you've got to be professional. You can't just sort of go clattering into a guy and get a red card because you're upset. But I was so disappointed because I thought, like, A, at the time, there wasn't enough reaction. There wasn't enough reaction when Leno went off and like, Leno was pointing the finger, but he was also showing his teammates, you know, this was a serious incident. You've got to come back and do
something. And that's the guy. That's the guy what done.
He was literally pointing at the guy who needed to get done, right? And I thought, okay, well, look, they'll go in at halftime and they'll obviously get some updates, some information on Leno and the injury that he's had. And they're going to come out and they're going to be aggressive. They're going to be intense. They're going to want to, you know, do it for Leno, in inverted commas. You know, things like that should galvanize a team. They should cause them to come together, to raise the intensity levels. And it didn't happen. And that's, I don't know whether it's to do with what they're being told at halftime in the dressing room. I don't know if it's like Arteta trying to keep cool and look, just don't lose your reason. I don't know if it's just the personalities of these players. I think it was quite informative that it took until after the final whistle for anybody to have a go at Mope. And that was probably more to do with the fact that he scored the winning goal and maybe he was having a bit of mouth, you know, scoring the winner.
I'm sure he was.
Yeah, he looks like the kind, in fairness. He looks it.
I don't know him, but someone I know who watches Brentford a lot, where he was previously, after the Leno thing, did text me and say, as someone who's watched Mope a lot, he is absolutely that kind of player.
Yeah.
He's one of those sort of Paul Dickov, nice and sort of nuisance nightmare bastard strikers. And that is his game, and part of his game is the sledging and the bullshit, you know. He's like, and of course, Guendouzi, that's part of his character as well, so it's inevitable that there would be some kind of confrontation there eventually. But I agree, it came too late. And I think I was going to tweet this at half-time, but I didn't. But the half-time team talk for Mikel Arteta should have been the most simple one he's had to give so far.
Yeah.
Because Arsenal absolutely had a cause and a reason to feel hard done by and a reason to be annoyed and a reason to want to go on and win this game for Leno. And I actually think there's something happening right now at Arsenal that's really causing Arteta problems. And I think it's that his experienced players, probably what he and Steve Round would call his sort of leadership group or captain group, are kind of dissipating and kind of disappearing. So, you know, Luiz, for whatever we think of him, is one of those figures in the dressing room that people look up to, and he's not currently there right now, and he might not be there much longer. Xhaka, obviously, we're without him. Aubameyang, there's all this stuff about, you know, is he going to leave the club? Is he going to sign a new deal?
Yeah, yeah.
Mesut Ozil, need I say any more? The list of sort of big players in the dressing room, the ones that Arteta has and that he has lent on thus far, they currently aren't there for him and may not be there for him for much longer.
Yeah.
I also think there's a secondary point, which is even then, some of these characters are not the right characters to be those figures in the dressing room, to be in those positions.
Yeah.
So what we have is a really talented young group of players, but it is so essential that they are partnered with or that they are led by the right experienced professionals.
That's something Arteta said during the week, isn't it? You know, we have these young players and there's a danger if you put them in that, you know, if they don't have the right players around them to help them develop and to help them learn, they're not going to make the right progression. But then I look at, like, I think that's a fantastic point. You look at the senior players that we have and there are very few of them, I think, that if you're a young player, you're going to look at and say, well, you know, he's going to lead me. And look, we hear all the time about Luiz being a great guy around the dressing room and the training ground and all that kind of stuff. You know, but really, I worry.
if I gave you a young centre-half and said, find me a mentor for this young centre-half to make sure he turns into the best defender he possibly can, you wouldn't bring me David Luiz?
No. Or Mustafi.
Or even Socrates. I mean, Socrates is another kind of leader, experienced figure in that dressing room who, A, is injured, and B, isn't really in the plans anyway. In a funny kind of way, it's almost reminiscent of the fucking five captains bullshit, where all these figureheads, all these supposed leaders, when we needed them, basically disappeared. And I think that that is a huge problem at Arsenal. And if you were looking... You know, people talk about George Graham in the 80s and the talented young players that came through then. And it's a point that often gets made, but it was about having the right experienced pros to complement them. Mm. And I just don't think Arsenal have that. I think, you know, if you're Guendouzi, even in midfield, your role model is Xhaka. And we know that that's not exactly perfect. Up front, I mean, Aubameyang is a brilliant player. He's not necessarily someone you expect to lead and represent the club. He's not even the guy who led and represented the club in the contract negotiations.
Well,
so,
yeah. Speaking of which, let me just go on with another question here, because we've got a couple like this. Father Ted Arsenal, who's at Father Ted R, says, do you think that taking a pay cut has demotivated some of these players, especially since other teams didn't do the same? And Pappy, who's at KenMay_pad on Twitter, says, the wage cut decision feels stranger and stranger to me when even the relegation threatened teams haven't enforced one. Can this change the players' feeling regarding the club and our stature as a big club, if you could make the case that Arsenal are still a big club, you know? So do you think there's potentially the wage cut situation, when you look at it now, look at how quickly it was pushed through, look at how contentious it was, look at everything that went on around that, and you know, we were, I suppose, heartened, maybe that's not the right word, but reassured that when Mikel Arteta got involved and sort of led by example to say he was going to take a pay cut himself and all that kind of stuff, that the people got on board, it spoke to a good connection between the manager and within the squad and everything else. But, you know, is it impossible that this has created an issue for some of the players? Like, well, particularly some of the ones who, like, don't really view their long-term future at Arsenal.
Yeah, I think it could have done. I mean, certainly there was unhappiness about it at the time from some quarters of the squad, and there was discomfort about the way the negotiations were handled. Mm. And I think certain players didn't appreciate the head coach becoming involved because they felt they conflated a salary question with a selection question. And I think, you know, inevitably it's a risky thing for the club to have done because it can jeopardise those relationships. I mean, you know, I don't know for sure. It's impossible to say that's why Arsenal's performances aren't as good. I think, you know, that would be a stretch. But I would say it might have damaged some of the positive feeling and unity that was coming out of the club prior to the lockdown.
It's certainly, will have created an issue for some players between them and the club, if not necessarily between them and the manager, you know.
Yeah.
And look, you know, we were critical of David Luiz the other day, you know, for the Man City game and for the performance, and coming out afterwards is fairly risible to sort of say, well, look, my contract situation is, you know, I'm not using it as an excuse, but, you know, he was basically using it as an excuse. And we were critical of that, as we should be, because a player should be able to compartmentalize that issue with the job that he has to do on the pitch every time he crosses the white line, every time he's wearing an Arsenal shirt. So, you know, to sort of say, well, look, the players haven't done this or that in the game,
they're still professionals.
Brighton, they're still professionals, and they still have a job to do, and they should know what that job is. But I just feel like
they're just doing 12% less of it.
12.5. I mean, it just maybe has had an impact, and that then is a question for those higher up to answer.
It is a good question, because really, if you think about it, we want to see the players giving 110%, but these guys presumably are only giving about 97.5%.
Mm.
And that is the difference, right? 12.5% could make all the difference. That's why Brighton won.
Yeah.
I think, it's a really interesting point, and I think it... Do you know what, though? I think it probably is more pertinent in terms of how players' relationships with the club and maybe the executives are more broadly damaged than explaining why they're not doing so well on the pitch.
Mm.
But just coming back to the sort of the question of the experienced players, I really do think you can kind of separate this squad in two, and it's kind of about half a dozen quite exciting young teenage players and then a bunch of guys in their late 20s or early 30s who aren't really the right people to be shepherding these youngsters into the Premier League. And the problem is, they're the really expensive ones to replace.
Yeah, and they're hard to get rid of.
And they're really hard to get rid of.
Yeah, it is. That's a...
And Leno, actually, is one of the few who's in the right age bracket, like, in the middle. You know, Leno's one of the few who's, like, he's kind of in his prime, you know, and sort of someone you could potentially build around, and now we're going to be without him seemingly for quite a long time.
Yeah, and an interesting character too, Leno. You know, I know that there were times last season where he was not having any of the bullshit from his defenders. You know, it wasn't stuff that came out publicly, but there were certainly some conversations. You know, if you can imagine a player... you know, looking to blame the goalkeeper for his mistake. Leno's not having any of that and is quite forthright about it. So,
well, there was a touch of Jens to his reaction, wasn't there? That's, and, you know, it's an easy conflation to say, oh, another German goalkeeper. But there was, and I did like that in him. Mm. I mean, I think we will miss his personality as well as his ability.
Yeah, okay. Your question, I think.
This was an interesting question from Peter Hurst, who said, Arsenal have the most red and yellow cards in the Premier League. Maybe we're not soft anymore, or do we just get punished more than the others?
Yeah, I had a similar question from Pete Smith, who's at Pete Metallurgist on Twitter, who says, how to change the subconscious narrative that refs have of Arsenal being soft, which leads us having to high cards to fouls ratio and allows opposition players to commit large numbers of fouls without being booked. I mean, it is very interesting. If you were to go through the Premier League and say, who are the dirty teams or who are the really physical teams, you wouldn't put Arsenal in that bracket at all. At all.
No. But the only thing I would say is, I forget who did it. Someone at The Athletic did a thing where they got a table of all the, what do they call it? Like fouls to stop a counter-attack.
Yeah.
And I think Arsenal are number one or number two this season. So that probably contributes in large part to a lot of the bookings. The sendings off, I think, are just often a consequence of crazy decisions at the back that leave us in a sort of, you know, impossible situation. But I, the question about the narrative around Arsenal is a really fascinating one. And the perception of Arsenal desperately needs refreshing.
Well, yeah, look, I think we can go back to the very first question in this. When you look at the players, when an incident like Leno happens and they're not A, surrounding the referee, they're B, not surrounding Mope, they're not standing up for each other on the pitch. And I think when you have a player like Bissouma, for example, who is careering around, making foul after foul after foul, you know, I think at one point after maybe the seventh foul, they said, oh, Aubameyang's just gone over to have a word with the referee. You know, you need to do that after his second foul and his third foul. I'm not saying that, you know, we all have that image, remember, of Manchester United veins popping out, chasing Andy Durso around the pitch, you know, giving the referee a hard time. But you can talk to referees and you can, you've got to make it clear to the referee. You can influence things in that regard. You know, it's about leadership on the pitch. It is about leadership. And we don't really have it from anybody in what we would consider the traditional sense.
And it wasn't pleasant, you know, a lot of what that United team did. But as far as I remember it, Fergie's United team, they won some stuff. You know, they won a lot of things. Something worked there, you know. And it's interesting because one thing Steve Round spoke about is, oh, we don't want to see dissent from the players towards each other. You know, if a player makes a bad pass, we don't want to see them throwing their hands up or calling that player out. And I think there's a lot to be said for that. But dissent towards others that shows unity as a team is absolutely fine by me.
Oh, yeah.
And should be fine by them too.
100%. 100%.
I mean, I couldn't help but think of you know, you think of 2003, don't you, in Old Trafford and Martin Keown and the way that everyone rounded on Ruud van Nistelrooy after what happened with Patrick Vieira. But you go through that team and there are probably, you know, probably 8, 9, 10 players who you can imagine getting in someone's face after an incident like what happened to Leno.
Yeah. And
it's harder to think of someone who wouldn't.
Yeah, exactly. And look, we have one of those players as our technical director. And I really hope that Edu, who was in the team with Lauren, who was in the team with Keown and Patrick Vieira and Ray Parler and these big, big characters, Dennis Bergkamp, Thierry Henry, you know, these huge characters on the pitch, can look at this Arsenal squad and look at this Arsenal team and see that such a fundamental part of what makes a team effective is missing. Mm-hmm. If he can't see that, and if that's not something that they're looking to address, then I'd be really, really, really worried. But of course, we've no idea what Edu is doing or what his remit is or whether he's allowed to talk to us about that or not, you know? So,
I mean, it's I actually don't have anything to say. Sorry, I started down that road and I was like,
it's, okay.
Oh, it's just more of the
same. What else is there? What else is there to say other than this is something that's missing and it's something that needs to be addressed? It's also something that, to a certain extent, can be taught / coached.
Fostered, yeah.
Fostered, that's a really good way of putting it, yeah. So,
I hope so, but like I say, I do have concerns that maybe the core personalities that you'd want to help that happen maybe aren't there. And it's not just Edu, by the way. It's Freddie Ljungberg as well. On the
true.
He was around in that period. And everything that we kind of learn about Arteta suggests that that intensity really is there in him as well, but it's not on the pitch. What about this one? Eddie Longbridge, a lot of people have asked this, and we touched on it in part one, but hi, guys, why do you think Arteta's been reluctant to use Martinelli, or the Martinelli, as Eddie says? We all love the Martinelli, and we want to see him play. How can Mikel Arteta not want this too?
I don't really have an answer to that, to be honest. I guess the incompatibility with Aubameyang on the left is the main issue. Like, he wants to keep Aubameyang on the left-hand side. He doesn't want to play him. Doesn't want to start him at centre-forward. And he doesn't want to move in there during the games. And where Martinelli is really effective is from that left-hand side. I mean, I think from speaking to people, it's not a question of a lack of faith in his talent or his potential.
No.
Because they do really, really think he's a fantastic prospect. Whether there's an issue with an injury or something, we're not quite 100% sure about, but, you know, surely if he's on the bench, he can do 15, 20 minutes off it, you know?
Yeah, I did hear that he hadn't returned to training quite, you know, he was a little bit behind some of the others in terms of his fitness. So maybe that has been a factor. There's no injury, for sure. It is an odd one to have not played a minute thus far. But I also wonder if they're... It's partly to do with the availability of two other players that Arteta does seem to have taken a real shining to. One is obviously Bukayo Saka, and that we all agree with and concur with, and they, you know, I suppose are competing for a similar position on left wing, although Saka's not played there yet. And the other is Eddie Nketiah, because I know you heard Mikel's press conference before the Brighton match, and he was absolutely effusive in his praise of Nketiah. And from what I understand, he really, really likes him. That's not to say he likes him more than Martinelli, but I just think it creates a competition for game time, basically. But I am surprised, nonetheless, that we've not seen Martinelli so far, because someone with his energy, his speed, his movement, you can imagine him affecting a game as a substitute.
Yeah, and I think one of the things, you know, when you're a team which struggles to create as we are, which has a dearth of creativity from midfield, you know, there's no question we've got issues with creating chances for our forward players. You know, the Pepe goal came out of nowhere. We don't have players who can pick the pass. You look at the game against City and those chances to play Aubameyang through where, you know, we talked about those and just, you know, it might be an issue of sharpness. It might be an issue of just lack of vision from some of those players. You need players who can kind of get you goals out of nothing. And that isn't to say that Martinelli's movement or predatory instincts in the box are nothing, but they're qualities that can transform what might look like a fairly routine cross, something that's easy for the opposition to deal with, into something dangerous. So that's where I really would like to see Martinelli come in, even if he's not starting. You know, this is a guy who in 20 minutes could give you a goal threat that's not coming from anywhere else. You know, because particularly away from home, it's not coming from Lacazette. Aubameyang had some moments. Pepe had his, like, little moment out of the blue. But it's not like we were making chance after chance after chance. So, you know, if you don't have goals coming from the center of your midfield, which we don't, you're really reliant on those forward players. And for me, Martinelli is a player who's got enough individual ability to score us goals. And I would be surprised not to see him involved in some way against Southampton on Thursday.
Yeah. Can I run this tweet by you? It's not a question, but it's a tweet I saw, and I'd be interested in your reaction to it. It's from Squid Boy, who's at the Squid Boy Light. And he said this thing about, I'll quote him, "Remember how football used to be about a solid structure at the back and individual genius up front? I'm convinced it's flipped. Now you need excellent individuals in defence and a cohesive unit going forward. But maybe that's just an Arsenal-specific issue." I just thought that was a really interesting observation because it does seem to be like the issue Arsenal face, that, you know, we are looking for like a Van Dijk, a Saliba-type figure to be the individual solution in defence. And in attack, we're like, oh yeah, we've got loads of quality players, but we don't seem to have a system that necessarily can make the most sense of them.
Yeah, I mean, look, you can point to someone like Van Dijk as having that individual brilliance and transforming the Liverpool defence, right? Mm. Providing that extra quality that they've needed for a long, long time. But they also brought in a very expensive goalkeeper. And they also
a couple of good fullbacks
came through their academy, and they also have what we don't have, which is a strong running, athletic, cohesive unit in midfield. And they've got interchangeable parts in midfield. Mm-hmm. You know, they can make it work with a number of combinations in there, and then they have individual brilliance up front from Salah, Mane, and Firmino. So, I come back to what I was talking about in terms of a midfield. You know, there's no question. Two big areas for me this summer are the centre of the defence, which we're going to get one addition in Saliba, you know, already being thought of as our Van Dijk and things like that, which to me feels like I really hope he is. I really, really hope he's as good as people are saying. But it feels like a lot to pin on a kid coming into this criticism.
He cost half what Van Dijk cost. So by any reasoning, I guess he should be half as good.
Yeah. But the centre of our midfield, is something that needs to be addressed. So those
Thomas
two
Partey better be cheap and he better be good.
Party time. Give them Lacazette and I don't know whatever else we could give them.
Sorry, just in terms of like the structure going forward, I do think it's worth pointing out that prior to the lockdown, we did have a shape that did sort of work. And it was maybe predictable in terms of having that front five and Saka being the overlapper from fullback and Ozil playing as a kind of 10. It was maybe predictable and maybe a bit one-dimensional for some people's liking or a bit lopsided, not quite symmetrical. But it kind of was working. You know, Saka was getting in on that overlap and it was pretty effective. And actually, in the two games we've seen since the restart, we've done different things to that and quite different things to each other. We've gone from a team that kept it incredibly simple to one trying to implement more complex ideas.
Yeah.
And I do think that, you know, we are struggling partly as a consequence of that. Does that mean it's the wrong decision? I don't think it necessarily does, because maybe coming to terms with these more complex ideas is sort of the next stage in the team's development. And maybe Arteta has to discover who can do that and who can't. Mm. And maybe it takes a bit more time. But I do think clearly there has been a change of plan. And that does partly, at least, explain the change in results.
Yeah, well, OK. Let's take this question here from R, who's at roly-poly throw-in, something I would like to see a lot more of in football.
Sure.
Just roly-polies and then throwing the ball in. If nothing else, that would give us some entertainment as Arsenal fans, although all our players would break their necks doing it. Three positive things you'd like to see from the last few games of this season that are realistic.
I'd like to see Pepe find some consistency, because we all see in flashes what he can do. And, you know, if he can produce that regularly, then Arsenal have another player who's in the kind of right age bracket to be a mainstay of this team. So that's one. Mm-hmm. Feel free to chip in, Andrew.
Let me think about this. What I would like... Three positive things that are realistic. Martinelli is one for me. Getting him back in the team and getting some minutes under his belt, because, you know, he feels like the future. Aubameyang, much as I like him, does not feel like the future. And Lacazette, our £50 million will toward, is definitely not the future. You know, he sort of runs around like an old man these days. He looks like a shadow of himself, which is a bit sad. So Martinelli would be one. Three positive things which are realistic. Another one would be to tie down Saka to a new contract.
Yeah, that's a big one for me. And actually, I don't really care where Saka plays, because he can kind of do the lot. I mean, and certainly if you've got a player who can do the lot, maybe the centre of the pitch is the right place to put him, because...
Yeah, particularly when you're about to... You need to rebuild that area of the pitch.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I think he really can play that sort of number eight role. I think he's got all the tools. And I thought he was one of the few Arsenal players to emerge with some credit. I mean, what he will... continue to do if he performs like that is increase those wage demands, but I absolutely think he's worth it. I mean, I'm convinced if you're a big club in England or in Europe, you must be all over Saka's agent right now. And it terrifies me to think that, but of course it's realistic.
No, I agree with you, and it's, you know, it is realistic. I think it is realistic for Arsenal to be able to tie down an 18-year-old prospect who's grown up at the club. If it, you know, we've spoken before about what should happen if it doesn't go through, but let's hope that that is something that does go through, because I think it is realistic, and something we can expect to happen. What else could I think of? I know some people will probably say this is ridiculous, but I still have a kind of a more positive outlook on Joe Willock than a lot of people. So I wonder if the central midfield issue might see him get a few more minutes under his belt. I mean, I'm just looking to the future, really, and getting the younger players as many positives as we can. Maybe two. Would it be realistic to hope that Hector Bellerin rediscovers some of the form that he showed in the past, if not the necessarily recent past?
Yeah, I mean, they say it can take you 2 years to come back from a cruciate injury. And we're still a little bit short of that. But I am worried that he has potentially lost the thing that made him absolutely outstanding, which was that explosiveness, you know. That was what separated him, in a very literal sense, from others. And
I'd be fascinated to see what the training metrics are.
Yeah.
In terms of the pace that he used to have and where he is now. Because, you know, it's not unusual for a player to lose some pace as they get older. You know, as they head towards their 30s, that blistering pace drops off. But it feels like with Hector, it looks like it's gone way quicker than you would have liked.
Well, the ACL isn't the only injury, is it? I mean, he had the ankle injury as well. So I would be fascinated to know. It's also not just the capacity to reach that speed, but it's the capacity to repeat it. It is a worry. But and I we all love Hector, right? We all think he's great, and we want to see him at his best. So that would be a huge lift. I'd like to see more games from Kieran Tierney. Personally, I was disappointed he didn't play this game.
Really?
Yeah.
I mean, I was disappointed because. I think it's reasonable to prefer him to Kolasinac, right? I think that's fine. But was it realistic for a guy who hasn't played a game in 7 months to have played 90 minutes against Manchester City on Wednesday night playing with 10 men?
Yeah.
I don't think it was realistic.
Maybe not, but I still, as a fan, when I turn up and I saw that team sheet and I saw it's Kolasinac, not Tierney, I still felt disappointed. Like, sure. I want to see him play.
I get it from an emotional point of view, but I think from a being realistic, we have to just sort of say, look, that's a lot to ask of a guy who's been out of action for 7 months.
Absolutely. But in this period, I do want to see if he can play two games a week. But I do think that, because I'm concerned that he can't, because I'm not sure he has at any point for us yet.
No, he hasn't yet, but I mean, is that not something that needs to happen over time? Is that not something he needs to build into his fitness? I mean, what if we played Tierney and Tierney pulled a calf or a hamstring in this game, people would say, you're a fucking idiot. Why are you playing Tierney?
They say that to me anyway.
I didn't mean you. I just meant, you know, in general, that the decision was a foolish one because you're not managing a player's fitness properly. I mean, it's a balancing act, I know, and it's a quality issue because, for me, I'd much rather see Tierney than Kolasinac.
Yeah.
But in this situation, I understood it.
I do understand it in this situation, but to be fair, maybe the season isn't long enough for me to see him play two games a week. I don't know. But I would like to see it, and I also just want to see more of him. I feel like we're all kind of going off his debut to an extent, which was in the Cup, and he was brilliant that night, swinging crosses in from the left, and we all thought, here we go. And we just haven't seen him with any kind of consistency, and I really hope we do, because I actually think there's a really, really good player there, proper modern fullback who can sort of do it all. And actually, in terms of character, and in terms of being competitive and showing a bit of fight, anyone who saw Tierney play in Celtic knows that psychologically he is tough. He is tough. Like, he is someone who, he's not the biggest bloke, but he'll go into any challenge absolutely fearless. And I think that we could really do with someone like that. I thought Arteta actually managed Kolasinac quite smartly in this game by basically massively reducing the space that he covered. You know, the problem with Kolasinac is when he bombs forward, he can't get back. He can't go in the direction. So he basically said, sit in as a third centre-half. And Kolasinac, he wasn't brilliant, but he got away with playing in a back four because he wasn't trying to do anything else.
Yeah.
But Tierney lets you do so much more.
Yeah.
And in terms of the shape and getting that overlap and someone replicating a bit what Saka did, I do think he has, in theory, the athleticism to do that.
Okay. Have you got one more or...
I do, actually.
Yeah.
It's a bit somber, but I think it's worth asking. So it was from Paul W, who's at PaulieT33 on Twitter. And Paul says, I hate to ask this, but what if Arteta isn't as good as we all hope and want? We're pinning an awful lot on an unproven manager. He looks the part. He talks the part, but has a lot to do. I'm not for 1 minute suggesting we sack him, but is it a cause of worry?
It would be ridiculous for there not to be worries about hiring a manager who's never managed before. And to manage a club which is going through a period of... What would you say this period is? I mean, how would you describe it? I mean, look, we all knew that the post-Wenger years were going to be somewhat turbulent, that there was going to be you know, an impact. But, you know, I think we're going through a decline, right?
So yeah, I wanted to call it transition, but I think transition, decline is more
decline,
accurate.
Clearly decline is obvious when you look at our footballing performance over the last number of years. It would be wrong for there not to be worries about it. What if he's not as good as we all hope he is? Well, we won't know this season, and maybe we'll know next season, and then we can make a decision. But if he turns out not to be good enough, the answer is sack him and bring in somebody else, because that's what happens at football clubs. But I think, and I don't want to sort of hammer home this point again, because we've had this discussion a few times, I think it's incumbent on us to look at the situation at Arsenal as a whole, and not just think that the issue is with the manager, the guy who's picking the team. I think there are issues with the ownership. I think there are issues with the executive structure. Maybe not so much the structure, but the executive personnel. I think there are significant things to worry about at that level too. And if Arteta turns out to not be good enough and we sack him and we bring in another manager, my faith in the people making that decision and making that appointment will be pretty much rock bottom, because they were the ones that brought in Unai Emery. They're the ones that stuck with Emery. They're the ones that then would have appointed another manager who doesn't make it. And of course, I just want to be clear, I really like Mikel Arteta. I really have a lot of hope and faith that he can do the things that he says he wants to do. So I'm not sort of countenancing any campaign or anything like that. But, you know, that's the reality. If he turns out not to be good enough, he gets the sack, as with managers everywhere in football. So,
yeah.
But don't be blind to other things that are going on at the football club. That's all I'll say.
No, that's fair. I think on Arteta, because he came from Man City and because he's, I don't know, Spanish, and because he worked with Guardiola, I think there was a slight presumption that technically he was sort of going to be flawless, that he was this guy who understood football like sort of Neo in the Matrix, and therefore Arsenal would suddenly play beautiful stuff. And actually, technically, we know about his beliefs. We know about the sort of football he wants to play, but we don't know masses about his technical capacity as a coach, right? I think we assume it's good, but we don't know that. And there will be holes, there will be flaws. Like anyone who's new in any job, something like the substitutions, he will fall short in areas, he will get things wrong. What I think we do know about him, partly because he did this job for Pep as his assistant culturally and in terms of kind of, you know, helping him interact with players, from everything he say, from everything we know about his time at Arsenal, Arsenal are in desperate need of a sort of cultural revolution at London Colney. And I think that Arteta has the right personality to lead that. And it may be long and it may be bloody and there may be big casualties, but I think that Arteta has the personality to finish the job that Emery actually tried to do. Emery failed to implement a cultural revolution at Arsenal and shift out some of the big personalities he didn't want around and change the way the club was perceived and change the way, you know, the intensity of the players. He did fail. But I think he failed because of certain personal qualities that he lacked. And I think Arteta has those qualities. And although his name is, his title is head coach, I actually think he can manage this group. Maybe he needs more support on the coaching side. From a technical perspective, it's Albert Stuvenberg who's principally advising him. Maybe he does need a more experienced head alongside him, someone who's been a manager before. But I genuinely think when we talk about these senior players, we talk about them not being the right types of personalities, and we need someone to have the balls, basically, to move them on and also identify the right people to support this young and guide this young cohort of players, I think Arteta does have that capacity.
It's very much shades of George Graham era when he took over and he came in, he got rid of all the, you know, the Charlie Nicholas, the Champagne Charlie players, and had a you know, a very promising group of young players coming through. So, you know, there's, look, I'm not saying history can repeat itself or anything like it, but it's just interesting that this is sort of, is quite similar in terms of the trajectory and in terms of what needs to be done to get the club and to get the team back on track, you know.
Yeah. Sorry, just to say, to give another shout out to Tim Steelman, he tweeted about the job that Pochettino did at Spurs in terms of, you know, transforming to an extent the perception of that team, you know, that they were incredibly soft and flaky and then they became this kind of hard running, hard tackling, very physical side. Pochettino really did implement that shift, and I think Arteta can too. And let's be clear, sooner or later, it has to happen.
Yeah,
it has to happen, and it will be painful. And if we were to, no one's suggesting this, but if we were to jettison Arteta now, we'd be looking for another manager who could do that same job,
or who wanted someone to has do it. To, yeah,
someone has to rip this up, basically.
Yeah,
and I think my position is basically, I think it might as well be Arteta because I believe he can carry it through better than the guy we had before.
Sure. Look, he, you know, he's got a great grounding as a player. He understands the club as well. He was captain of the football club. He wants the football club to be what it was. He understands what Arsenal should be, you know? So yeah, to go absolutely. At the job in that, in with that kind of mindset, I think we can all get behind that, even if people have worries about his inexperience or his ability to manage games or his in-game management, et cetera, et cetera. Those are things he can learn. But I think just from the point of view of what he wants Arsenal to be and how he wants it to get there, I feel like that's something most Arsenal fans should be able to get behind. The one thing I would say, and I've said, you know, we've said this before, is that it is going to require patience from us, which isn't always easy, of course, because football is such a short-term business and everything else, but also significant support from the people above him who have to enable some of the work that he wants to do. They have to make things happen in terms of getting players to sign new contracts, selling players, buying players, recruitment. You know, is he going to get that support? Are some of Arteta's ideas incompatible with some of the way that some of the people at executive level want to operate? There's a very interesting sidebar to all that as well. So,
yeah, it will be interesting. And also, it will be quite traumatic. I mean, we will lose more games this season, at least. You know, we will lose more games. And I don't mean by that it's okay to lose games. You know, Arsenal should beat Brighton even while they're undergoing this decline, even while we're in this transition. But it is also inevitable that there will be pain, you know?
Yeah. Well, just to go back, before we finish, just to go back to that question about positive things that we want to see from the between now and the end of the season that are realistic. Let's see some personality. Let's see some personality that tallies with what our idea of Arsenal is. And it might sound very ephemeral and everything else, but I think everyone knows what I'm talking about, you know, when it comes to that kind of a thing, whether that's from the manager, whether it's, you know, in terms of our performances, whether it's individuals, whatever it might be, whatever happens between now and the end of this season, which I think we're looking at being pretty much a write-off. But let's see some personality, some green shoots. I think what we saw from Arteta and the team pre-lockdown, I'm not saying it was massively improved, but I felt very much like there were green shoots there for us to sort of water. Sure. We've taken a little bit of a step backwards in the last couple of games, and it's easy to feel disheartened and everything else. But I think we would be wrong to forget about those things. So let's see a bit of that between now and the end of the season. Whatever happens in terms of results, you can even lose games and take positives from them. You know, you can see things that might be positive from the way we play or the way that we try to play or our intentions within the game. You know, let's see some of those things. And then we can build on those in the summer, hopefully, provided that, you know, the people whose job it is to make the changes can do it efficiently and well. So,
yeah, but I mean, I think there is huge pressure and huge onus on them to do it, but it is in much more difficult circumstances now than 12 months ago. And if you can query the job they did 12 months ago, it's going to be harder now. So, yeah, I mean, massive responsibility on the club in that respect.
All right. Well, look, we're going to leave it there because this has been a bit of a marathon. Thank you, as always, for being here. Thanks for listening and subscribing and all of that kind of stuff. We are going to have another Arsecast Extra on Friday morning because we're playing Thursday night against Southampton. Let's hope we can get a win under our belts. Third time lucky in the post-COVID-19 world. Again, we'll catch you on the next one. Until then.
Bye-bye.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.